Okay, so I'm really glad you brought this up. I realize you are the interviewer, but you have just touched on a level of trauma that actually is the reason. No, I'm serious. It's the reason why I also walked away from Daily News. I was in Daily News for over a decade.
In this episode, you'll get to know Christabel Nsia Buadi, the empowering creator. And you'll hear the story of how she used her love of her family and community to build a long and prosperous career. I'm Dave Crenshaw, and this is My Success Project. Welcome back, friends, to the Dave Crenshaw Success Project. This is the show that's all about me teaching my children how to be successful through the life stories of others, but you get to come along for the ride, no matter what your career is, no matter what your age. In case it's your first time here, I'm a best-selling author. I speak around the world to Fortune 500 companies, and I've taught millions of people how to be successful through my online courses. With this show, I wanted to create something a little different. It's a passion project for me. I wanted to create something that would help my family succeed, in particular my three children. And I thought you'd also enjoy learning along with them. On this show, I speak to some of the most successful people I've met in my life's journey. These are people who have achieved balanced, multifaceted success. And as we go through their story, I'm looking for universal principles of success that you can apply in your life and career right now, no matter who you are, where you are, or what you do. And that's what this success project is about. As you listen to today's episode, look for something you can do, an action that you can take this week. And if you do that, you'll make my guest and her story a part of your life forever. And you definitely want to make my guest a part of your life. Christabel Nsia Buadi is an award-winning radio journalist, and her writing has been published in the newspaper The Independent, British Vogue, and Shondaland. She is the CEO of My Lens Media, and she developed and led Spotify's groundbreaking production fellowship, Sound Up, Behind the Mic. She also developed a mentorship program for podcasters called Narrative Shift. When she isn't working with other creators, she's interviewing creative trailblazers on her podcast, The Cipher. Christabel is a fellow of the Royal Society of the Arts. I'm so thrilled to talk to you today, Christabel. Thank you for coming on the show.
Oh my goodness. Thank you so much for inviting me. I am really honored and excited to be here with you.
So I always like to ask this question, where are you? I think most people are going to think you're somewhere in the UK, but you're not.
Well, they're wrong. I'm in Los Angeles. I'm in Los Angeles, California. Yeah, I've been here for a while.
Oh, well, thank you for being here and lending your ability to the United States. We appreciate that.
You are absolutely welcome. I'm thrilled. It is an adventure and hope it continues to be.
So let's dive into your story. You know, the premise of this show is that I'm first teaching my kids how to be successful through the stories of others, but everyone else listening also is learning from that. So I always like to start with a fun question, which is when you were younger, what did you want to be when you grew up? What did you think you would become someday?
I wanted to be either a lawyer or a journalist. I had a very, very clear sense of wanting to right wrongs and speak up for others. Always. That's always been that for me.
So what created that interest in righting wrongs?
Personal. Obviously, right? It's always personal, isn't it? Well, I know that I grew up, I'm the child of Ghanaian immigrants born in Scotland. And this is a connection to audio as well, right? And I always understood that the house that I lived in was very vibrant. And things always happened to people in my community that always seemed unfair. But also just the vibrant life that I had internally was not reflected in the external world that I also lived in school and in public spaces. But more often than not, I often saw people who didn't have a voice. I felt like they were treated badly. They were underestimated. They were ignored. They were just, you know, like, they're never going to be able to do that. And so as somebody who loved words and as somebody who loved listening to people, I don't know, I just very passionately felt like if I have these skills that people saw in me quite early, as somebody who loved words, as somebody who was good at writing, as somebody who was good at orating, I wanted to use that to help my community, whatever that community looked like. And it wasn't just the Ghanaian community. It was my working class, you know, peers that they understood as well. Just people who didn't really seem to have access to that microphone, you know, and like yeah. My dad would get pulled over by the police for reasons that we never really understood. I remember being 7 and driving on the motorway, and we got pulled over by the police, and my dad was like, okay, here we go. And I remember thinking, I don't understand, what did he do? So it was things like that, I think, that really inspired me to do that.
So just a personal comment, one of my favorite places that I've been to speak was Ghana. So when you talk about the vibrant community, I'm thinking about that. Oh yeah, there was a huge party and they got me up to dance, which you can imagine just about as well as you think it would. But let's pause on that for a second, though. So in Scotland, was there a community, an African community there?
I mean, yeah, that's how my parents ended up there. My dad, he came to study, and his cousin was in Scotland, in Glasgow, and lo and behold, believe it or not, there was a vibrant Ghanaian community there. I often think about this because I recognize that my first language is probably Twi or Fanti, which are languages that I understand, but I don't speak as much these days. Yeah, it was a vibrant community. And so people would come to my parents' house and talk about their day and talk about how they interacted with these foreigners in this foreign land. And that's what I understood. While I was also listening to music in the background, because music was always playing and somebody was always cooking something. It feels very stereotypical in some ways, but that was ultimately, when I think about some of my first memories, it was that.
So you saw this kind of, this treatment, for instance, as you mentioned, with your father, which is terrible that sort of thing happened and continues to happen. Mm. And you think, I want to right wrongs. Where did you first get your foot in the door to start doing that kind of thing? So did you originally take the lawyer pathway at all, or was it primarily journalism?
No, okay. I realized very quickly when I was doing my GCSEs, because I grew up in the UK. So the first set of like major national exams at the age of 15, you take them, GCSEs. I wasn't actually built to be a lawyer. Because I remember saying to myself, if I know someone's guilty, how am I going to get through that? Which, very judgmental, you know, as a 15-year-old, well, they obviously did it. How am I supposed to support them? And, you know, in hindsight, I'm like, you know what? Everything's a bit more gray. But that's what put me off. I realized I didn't quite have the stomach for it, or I felt I didn't have the stomach for it, I should say. Mm. And look, to be blunt, you know, I'm the kid of a generation where I'm watching TV and I'm listening to radio, and that looked far more attractive to me. So I think there was an element of like, I think I also want to be famous. Why don't we just do that? But I also saw the power in that too. So I never took the bar. I took the route on studying history and literature. And I was actually a gifted artist, a visual artist, but I did not take that as A-levels because, well, what are you going to do with an A-level in art, you know, other than loving
it? What is an A-level for someone who's not familiar with that?
So after you do your GCSEs, which is across the country, if you decide you don't want to leave school and go and find a job or do a BTEC, which is a different kind of next level, advanced level education, A-levels, which is advanced level, is a continuation of your school education. And that is typically the route that takes you into university.
So. Okay. Well, there's something already about your story that I like, which is the mindset that you adopted was very entrepreneurial. Because I think a lot of people, they go, well, a lawyer is what I want to do. That's what I should do. And they just continue on the path regardless of how difficult that may be. And that's wonderful. But typically entrepreneurs, they go, that's way too much work. And they look for an easier way to do it. And it sounds like entrepreneurs are lazy. And I'm not necessarily saying that, but I'm saying we do kind of look for the angle, right?
Always.
What's the simpler path to get what I want?
It makes me laugh because as I was telling you, I was thinking, oh, I was just being lazy. Absolutely 100% lazy. But you've made me feel good because now you're saying, no, it was an angle. But you're right. It was absolutely an angle. I was like, what's the thing that I would be passionate about, but would also have impact. I was aware of impact, right? Because I was aware of power as well and influence at that time. How do I have influence? And what's the thing that is less hassle, quite frankly? I mean, I knew it'd all be work. I was never not a hard worker. But I was like, that seems like less hard work and less stressful. I'm going to do that instead. So yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I don't think there's any shame in that. And sometimes also what we think is easy is actually very difficult for other people.
Oh, yes.
We assume that it's easy for everyone simply because it's easy for us. Right?
Yes.
So for you, you had that gift and that ability for journalism. And clearly, and we'll get to the long-term story here, clearly you've been successful with that. So where were the first forming moments where you started to get your foot in the door and you started to have some success with journalism?
Believe it or not, the first job that I had was at age 18 while I was doing my A-levels, and my teachers saw that in me as well. And I will say this, as a kid, I wasn't shouting to the world, I want to be a journalist. I would say it to a few teachers that I trusted, but I wasn't that kid who said, I'm going to be a journalist and I'm going to be a news anchor and it's going to happen. I was actually quite quiet about that, but I was loud about everything else. I think I was quite scared about that because I didn't actually think it would come true. I will answer your question, but I remember being age 15, saying to myself, to my 40-year-old self, somehow, remember saying, it's going to be okay. Because in that moment at age 15, I was very scared and everything was very, very hard. But I was like, tell me what it's going to be like. I'm sending you this message now. I think it's going to be okay, but I don't know how we're going to make it. So then 3 years later, when I'm doing my A-levels and in the midst of being very stressed about my academics, my teachers say, there's this opportunity. Someone's reached out. We'd like you to, you have permission to audition. So I auditioned and I was absolutely not polished at all. There was a TV show called Life School. They were looking for student reporters. And my school said, yeah, they basically put me forward for that. And I auditioned for that. And I went through several rounds of auditions. And I just remember being absolutely petrified. And I made the last round somehow. And I'm walking into this room with 5 or 6 other kids. Other kids that in my mind are well, far more put together, definitely more affluent in that sense. They seem to have access that I didn't have. We had a conversation, and then a few days later, they said, you've got the job. You and 2 other students will be presenting this show on sexism. And okay. Yeah, exactly. And I was just like,
let's start you with something really easy.
Right, right. And I was like, okay. And it was just one show. And so I met with the other 2 student journalists, so to speak, and we worked with a production company. So that was my first job. And my first break into broadcasting. So I got a taste of that. And I knew immediately that that's what I wanted. But it wasn't until years later that I basically found a way through. It wasn't easy at all after that.
Okay. So you got that first opportunity. I think sometimes people think, oh, I got the break, right?
Oh, yeah.
And the break sets everything up. But that's not typically how life goes, right?
Nope.
So
not at all.
Talk to me a little bit about that difficult journey after you got that opportunity to the point where it actually started to become a career. What was that climb like? What were you experiencing?
So I did the show and it was great. I ended up interviewing a gentleman who was fighting for men's rights and also lived in a part of England that I think I might have been the only black person. Myself and another kid would have been the only black person there. And I sensed some kind of hostility, but I really got a taste of what interviewing somebody would be like. And I really liked it because it's about listening, right? And it's about, in doing so, you often disarm people because they realize, oh, you're human too. We're human beings together and we have feelings, even if we don't meet in the same place. So I immediately was like, I love doing this because this gentleman who was on the back foot, defensive, and knew that he was being seen in a particular way, had this kid who, you know, this little punk basically asking him questions, but really kind of being like, what is it that you're fighting for? I'm really curious. And that completely disarmed him. So immediately at that point, I knew what was going on. So
I want to pause on that for a second, though.
All right.
Because that is what you just said there is so powerful, that listening disarms people. Mm-hmm. And it is a difficult skill, and it's especially difficult when you're interviewing people, because I feel like I'm trying to do that dance anytime I interview someone. So what have you learned that you could teach us about being an effective listener in a setting like that?
Okay. It's being quiet and being still. It sounds esoteric, but what I mean by that is this. When I'm interviewing people, you know, we have our script. And over the years, I've often said, okay, I have a script and suggested questions, but I know I'm not going to end up asking these questions, because when someone's talking to me, I'm getting to know them, and what they say is going to open the door to a completely different conversation. But my job as an interviewer is to do the baseline, which is get to know you by doing the research. You can't not do the research, right? Because that's going to inform the questions. But when you sit back and you let someone speak and you actually engage with them and listen, and at the moment, you know, for if you're listening to this just audio wise, can you tell that I work in audio? You know, you and I are looking at each other and we're talking. Even if we couldn't see each other, people know when someone is engaging, because it's not just the ums and the ahs, it's actually the silence. And as an interviewer, if you just pause and listen to the silence, because it often happens in the silence when somebody is not quite sure if they're safe enough to say that thing to you, or if they're thinking it through and you just give them the space to think about it, that's often when people recognize that they're safe and are disarmed, because you're not saying, well, what do you mean by that? I don't understand that. Can you explain that to us? Do you know what I mean? Like, it's a, oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. I'm reminded of the Miles Davis quote, right? It's not the notes that you play. It's the notes you don't play.
That's interviewing for me. That to me is interviewing. Listen to the silence, not because you're trying to play gotcha, but if you ask me a question and I'm thinking about it, that question more often than not probably means something to me. It's an indicator that I've thought about this thing. And so if I'm listening to you as an interviewer, I'm going to give you space, especially if you're recording the show, I'm going to give you space to be okay with that. And sometimes, and remember, a lot of people are uncomfortable with sharing stuff with strangers and then sharing stuff with strangers on a microphone and sharing stuff with strangers on a microphone that might, you know, to other people around the world. So you have to be kind. You have to be really kind to the person that you're speaking to.
Yeah, I think those are principles that apply not just to interviewing, but any aspect of our life as well, which is why I'm so glad you highlighted them. Okay, so let's continue then with that story. You had that experience.
Was hooked.
Things evolve.
Yeah, was hooked. And then continued on the educational track because, you know, education is the key. That was drilled into me and I believe that. Get your big degree from your big university and everything will be fine. You will land your dream job, because they'll be wowed by your university degree and everything will be great. You and I know that that's not how that works.
Yeah.
So I got my big degree from my big university, and then I applied for a ton of jobs and I didn't get any. I was then offered a job by two production companies through the job that I did with Life School. One was a bigger production company than the other. And I didn't know what to do. I was offered these two jobs and my dad said, maybe you could be a big fish in a small pond. So I took this job with this production company, which I will not name, and spent a year there, and it was stressful and horrible. I was a runner there. I could not be myself. None of my ideas seemed to work. I was just not connecting with people. So then after that, when I was let go, a friend of mine, I applied for more jobs, did not get them, started to get really down. And this would have been 2 or 3 years out of university at this stage. And then I landed a job in a marketing department of a newspaper, which I will also not name. It's a big newspaper. Did that job for about 2 years, I think. And then I just had this feeling of, if I don't try to do this, I'm going to go nuts. I don't know what to do, but I was literally compelled to try and do something. So I started emailing journalism professors to see what I could do. I'd applied for, you know, journalism courses, but I felt I just wanted to get into it. And I applied to the United States because my boyfriend at the time was in the US. And I was like, I actually want to go there. So one journalism professor actually replied back. His name was Ralph Engelman. And I shout this man out every time, along Long Island University, I believe, in New York. And he said, I can see you're really passionate about this. I know someone who is looking for volunteers, if that's something that you're interested in doing. And I said, yes, please. And he gave me the name of this person. And then I nearly backed out because my fear was, I'm working for free. I'm not independently wealthy. I have to save this money. But what happens if it doesn't work?
That's a tough balancing act to consider, because on one side, I believe that you shouldn't do work for free. You should be valued. But on the other side, there is a point, I think, in everyone's career where doing that a little bit is useful. So how did you get past that concern, or how did you reconcile it in your mind?
Well, shout out to my big sister, because she said, while I was saying, oh my gosh, what am I going to do? I'm going to be stuck here. I'm not going to have any money. She said, well, what's the worst that could happen? If you go for 3 months and it doesn't work out, then you come back, but at least you tried. But if you go, and she said, and you come back, we're here for you. Like, nothing's going to happen. Everything will be here for you, but we'll all support you. But if you go back and something does happen, then what? And she said, it's only 3 months and we got you.
And oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah. My big sister has actually often pushed me to do things that I would be scared to do. And then I had to sell it to my parents, who were like, you're crazy. You have a job. You have a big job with this big newspaper, security. But I did it anyway. And then I landed in New York.
And that's where, so you would consider that a major turning point in your career, was accepting that opportunity?
Yes, the turning point. Because to give you context, that was also just after 9/11. So when I landed there, I was doing a lot of reporting.
Oh, yeah. Wow. The timing on that. So part of the reason why I wanted to highlight that in particular, though, is because it was a moment where you didn't want to do the thing, or where you almost talked yourself out of doing the thing that led to that success. And I'm highlighting that because that's something I experienced. I remember the first time I was invited to do a course for lynda.com, which is now LinkedIn Learning. I had the conversation with a mentor and I'm like, I don't know why I'm doing this. I don't know why I'm getting on this plane. This seems like a waste of time. Yeah, you know, it's just on and on. And it turned out to be one of the most important moments in my entire career. Mm. So I think we all experience those moments where we almost talk ourselves out of being successful.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I've done it regularly. And what I've come to see is that the points at which I have almost talked myself out of it, but actually embraced the fear that I, well, just embraced the fear and then jumped anyway, those moments have always been pivotal for me. They have been the moments that have changed things for me, because I think innately my instincts understood that I needed to do that, but my brain was telling me that, well, you have a vision of what it should look like. So it's really about, you know, brain sense and kind of like having faith in yourself and trusting your instincts, which I always, that's the battle for me. My brain is way too big and it often overrides things. But I can tell you wholeheartedly that every time that I have trusted my instincts, especially when it's petrified me, it's always worked out for the best, or for the better.
Has that become easier over time, to trust those instincts, because you have past experience, past data that you can look at and go, you know what, it worked out when I did that? Or do you still have the tendency to want to talk yourself out of those moments?
Oh, I absolutely still have the tendency to want to talk myself out of it. Okay. However, I have data now, don't I? Which is, it's happened before. So just, we'll see. But my thing is, I look at the lay of the land and I go, well, everything seems fine. Why would I want to change it? But I know why I want to change it, because I'm unhappy about something, and not just annoyed. There's a deep, deep frustration. And that is often the tell, right? It's like there's something that you need to shift. And sometimes you get pushed and sometimes you need to take the leap. I'm very loyal to a fault, actually, sometimes. And so sometimes I need to get pushed. And then, you know, my feelings are hurt and all those things happen. And then I go, oh, okay, but this is what I'm going to do.
Hmm. All right, let's continue that story then. Now, did that experience lead you to radio and audio broadcasting, the experience you had in New York?
Oh, yeah. The job that I had coming in, the volunteering job, was for a radio station. It was for WBAI, part of the Pacifica Network. And when I walked in, I had all of my emails, and the general manager looked at me and said, "Oh, hi, nice to meet you." And I said, "Oh, you said that I should come in and talk to you because you'd have some volunteering opportunities." And he looked at me and he said, "No, I don't have any volunteering opportunities." And my heart just went into my mouth. I nearly burst into tears. And I brought out all of my receipts, right? And I said, "No, this is what you said. And then he went, Oh, okay. And then he, realizing that he had to find a place for me because I wasn't going anywhere, he got me to volunteer with this news collective called Free Speech Radio News. And there was a young journalist there at the time who was the host of the show. And she will always deny this because now we're very, very close. We're basically, you know, aunties to each other's kids. We're family. But I remember like walking in and being like, "Hey," and her looking at me and kind of rolling her eyes a bit. But I think she was rolling her eyes because she knew that he was like, "Do something with this person." But she was very lovely. Even in that moment of frustration for her, and was like, "Do you know how to write? Have you reported before?" And I said, "I've never reported. This is what I want to do." But by the end of the day, she was giving me assignments to write minute-long news stories to then read. So she is the person who then taught me how to write for the ear, or rather gave me the experience to write for the ear, to go out into the streets and report, write around audio, and then cut that audio. So I had all of that experience. And then I built on that. And then a few years later, I got a job with Air America, the talk radio network that was launched in the early aughts. And again, I was given the opportunity to shape a show and to produce a show. And it was a station where Chuck D had a show and Rachel Maddow had a show on there at the time. And Chuck D walks in and he says, "Hi, my name's Chuck." And I'm like, "I know who you are. You're one of my heroes." So immediately I'm having this adventure. This is all because of me having faith and taking the leap, right?
Yeah. And a couple of mentors helping you as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Along the way, I did not do this by myself. People saw something in me that I didn't see in myself because I definitely did not have that confidence. But they kept on pushing me along the way because they also saw the passion as well. So I was at Air America for about 3 years, had an amazing time working with Laura Flanders. And then I applied a job for NPR. Yes.
Wow. And so I'm going to pause for a second here too.
Yeah.
My dad was a radio talk show host. So okay. I grew up around radio. So this is kind of a selfish question, but what is something about being in radio broadcasting that most people don't understand? Like, what's something that's unique to that experience?
It's not a bunch of people drinking coffee. It is really intense. It is lots of people running around, especially if you're on a daily show, regardless of whether it's the drive time show or whatever, you're constantly dialed in because you are, you know, if you're a DJ, a music DJ, which is actually what I also wanted to be way back in the day, in between being a lawyer and a journalist, you have to be on top of the, you know, the latest trends, the latest music trends. So you're constantly dialed in and you're obsessed with the thing. You know, I was a news producer, so I still have the reputation with my friends of knowing everything about the news, even when I declared that I don't read the news as much as I do. But I get their point because I absorb news via osmosis just because of my background as a journalist. So I think that's what people don't understand. You become obsessed with a thing.
The urgency of time.
Yes.
You have to act fast. And there's only this amount of time. You've got to do it within 60 seconds or 90 seconds or whatever you've got. And everything is around time. So if you're not watching right now, Christabel just put her hands over her heart. And I feel that. In fact, it's part of the reason why I've chosen not to make the news cycle part of my career, because it is relentless.
Okay. So I'm really glad you brought this up. I realize you are the interviewer, but you have just touched on a level of trauma that actually is the reason. No, I'm serious. It's the reason why I also walked away from Daily News. I was in Daily News for over a decade. And I was running a Daily News show at one point, and I had two phones, and both phones were giving me news. Like, it was constantly breaking news. And then I'm texting people. I'm texting my other show manager, "Well, we should do this," right? On a Sunday, while I'm supposed to be having lunch with my friends, right, to work out what news we're going to cover on Monday, and then we're annoying other people on a Sunday who are also as dialed in as us to make sure that they're on the show to talk to us for 90 seconds, for 1 minute, for 3 minutes, because this news is important. And as somebody who is already highly driven and really gets into it, I found myself almost tripping over myself constantly just to keep up with myself. It was so stressful, actually. Like, on one hand, I love the adrenaline of daily news, especially if it's a big news cycle. Like, I've covered 3 American elections. I've loved every single moment. I love being sleep deprived on election night. I did that as a teenager. I would just like watch the elections and be like, what is happening? This is amazing. So the idea of me doing that and getting paid for it was amazing until it wasn't. And I was just like, you know what? This isn't fun anymore, actually. What are we doing?
Yeah. So in your current work with audio, have you freed yourself completely from the news cycle, or is there still a little bit in there? I don't want anything to do with it.
No, I'm with you. Okay. I want absolutely nothing to do with it. So this actually goes back to the question you were asking about the business in Los Angeles, right? So I applied for a job with NPR. I got that job, shockingly, to be the senior supervising producer for a daily show called News and Notes, which was incredible because then it tied in my passion for amplifying underrepresented voices, because it was focused on the African-American community and connecting them with the diaspora. So I actually got to then talk about a community that I was part of as well.
And can you explain briefly to those who are not familiar with it, what is diaspora?
Diaspora, so I guess people outside of the core, for want of a better place. So if we talk about Africa, for example, the diaspora would include people who live outside of Africa but have roots in the continent, or were born outside of that and have family on the continent, or even if they don't have family on the continent, have roots in Africa. So when I talk about that, every nation has a diaspora. Right. So, but we often hear it when we talk about Africa. We talk about Africa and the diaspora, or the Black diaspora.
Okay. Thanks for that explanation.
Yeah. Not at all. So, as somebody who is a diasporan, aka somebody with African roots who was born outside of Africa but has family there, I always felt on the outside, you know, like in the UK, I was from the UK, but not really. But in Ghana, you were from Ghana, but not really, because you were born outside. Right. But I, over the years, have really, one of my the ways in which I define myself and the lens in which I look through is this idea of being a global family and looking at diaspora, not just from my personal experience, but it could be anything. But how are we all connected?
Yeah. And that gets back to that decision you made when you were a teenager, right? Mm-hmm. Of wanting to use journalism to help people understand your culture and what was going on and what people are experiencing, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. And you just said that, and I was like, oh yeah, you're absolutely right. That is absolutely it. So that's been the driving force for me. It's connection and understanding and just giving people space just to be. I never felt like I was ever allowed to just be. I had to present some version of myself to somebody else. But as I got older and more comfortable in my skin, I just feel like that's a fundamental right that everybody should have. So in all of my work, you see that as well, where I'm saying, just be yourself and be big about what that is. Because if we're emotionally honest with each other, then that's where the good stuff comes. That's where the joy is. That's where the connection comes from as well.
Yeah. And I love the fact that by you sharing your story, and in particular, you know, you've used audio as your primary medium, mm-hmm. right? That's a great opportunity for everyone to start to understand more of what your experience is like.
Exactly.
We tell these stories, we have this conversation with each other, and people understand a little bit more of what it's like to be living in Scotland.
Yeah, exactly right.
African, right?
Yeah. 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 That is exactly it. And just be like, it's normal, you know, or even if it's not normal, it's not even a case of I'm just like you. It's just, it's really cool. Like, let me tell you about this thing and let's laugh about these things together.
Yeah. Okay. So where did your business and your being entrepreneurial and starting your own business, where did that come in to this story?
That came in 2009 during the Great Recession. my big, wonderful job, and I use the term big on purpose. It is a theme that comes up on purpose. And I say that with a wry smile, ended. It was the most high profile job that I'd had. It was a job that I'd been paid the most for to that time at that point. And I was just like, oh, okay. I feel like I'm settled now. I feel like I've got my foot solidly on that ladder. And then the Great Recession hit. And then my show was cut for reasons that I don't know, but it was cut. And so I was left without a job. And yeah, I had to make some decisions about what my next stage was going to be. Was I going to go back to the UK?
Was that moment devastating?
It was absolutely devastating because I was helping my parents financially through that. I felt like I was in a position to do that too. My green card was actually being sponsored by NPR. I had a work visa, but they were like, we're going to change you to that. And all of that. And then I was saving because I wanted to buy a house. I was finally feeling like I could set roots in a place and it was probably going to be here. And all of that was taken away just like that. So I felt like I was in free fall in that moment. And then as a manager, I was having to break the news to my team and support them. And so, yeah, it was extremely devastating, actually. And I had to quickly think about what I was going to do. But also in that moment, because of the way in which the reasoning for the show being cut, they had introduced a new quote unquote diverse show, which I had challenges with, not because they had a new diverse show, but because I was like, the idea of constantly siloing people is problematic. And even though I was working on a show that focused on African Americans, that wasn't a siloing. It, like, there's a way in which you have to be intentional about bringing voices that have been ignored up to a point, with the idea of having it being included in the fabric so that it just feels like a normal and natural thing to do, right? But the need for the show that I was working on still existed, which is why they, in my opinion, created this other show. And then they got rid of our show. So it felt very calculated. And so I was very hurt as well. And that was the moment at which I said to myself, I can't work with people who do not value me or value the work that I bring to the table. And so I felt that my only option actually was, and I say that I felt it was my only option, but the truth is I'd been thinking about creating my own production company anyway. I wanted to freelance because I kind of wanted to inject, you know, these different voices into all of these different shows that I had a connection to. And I wanted to do that by having my own company, by freelancing, which is when My Lens Media was created.
So I have a book, The Focus Business, and in it, I have fun with comparing entrepreneurs to superheroes. And the reason why I'm bringing this up is because every superhero has their origin story, right? Uh-huh. Superman is destiny. Batman was a decision. But there's also the adversity story. That's Iron Man. That's being trapped in a cave, having to get yourself out of it. So he builds the Iron Man suit and the rest is history. Your origin story was one of adversity. Yeah. Right. And you were forced into a corner where you had to create this business. And that led to the success that you're now having 10, 12, 13 years later.
Absolutely. The first few years of having the business and, like, you know, talking to different radio stations and working with them and developing the content was hard. Right. And everything felt hard. But it got to a point where I said, this is the path that you take in number one, right? So a lot of what you have to do is about not just convincing people, but showing people that this is of value and this is the thing you need to do. But what I didn't realize was that in working with all of these radio stations, and at the time I actually framed it as I'm working for them as opposed to working with them or them being my clients. And that's huge. What I didn't realize was that there was a trail, right, that I was building. There was a portfolio that I was building that I didn't realize I was building that brought me to the attention of people that I didn't even know were paying attention to what I was doing. So I'm creating content for KCET, digital content for them. And it's all around my passion, right? This was in the early days of podcasting as well. So I developed a podcast in 2009, 2010, because I saw the potential of podcasting to diversify what we hear, right? And also to bring interesting and new voices to not the airwaves, but to our ears. So I created a podcast called Home From Home, where I interviewed people from the African diaspora who had made Los Angeles their home, creatives and artists. And I, because what I saw was that you're trying to make a home here, and the themes that you keep on coming around are similar to the themes that I have about finding a home. Let's talk about that. And then I worked with Marketplace, and then I worked with all of these other places that I'd worked with before. And so I'd built a portfolio. And then fast forward to, I want to say, late 2021, I get a call from Spotify, or for somebody at Spotify, saying, hey, would you be interested in facilitating and doing some work with us? And it was for a program that I loved, which was supporting underrepresented creators. And that job was really to be a facilitator on the program. So I would have been working with them through the company, right? And then I get another call and they say, actually, there is a fellowship that we're developing. Do you want to talk about that? And I'd said to everybody, I do not want to take another full-time job. I want to build my business. And everybody said to me, but this fellowship thing is exactly what is in your ballpark. This is kind of the thing that you want to do. Why wouldn't you want to talk about it? So I was like, fine. Took the phone call, had the conversation. I laugh at the fact that I actually can be quite naive and clueless sometimes, because I was like, it's just a conversation. We're just talking. Sure. So as we're talking, they said, would you be interested in having another conversation? Sure, I'll have another conversation. Great, we'll put it on the books. Have that conversation. They said, so we want to move you to the next stage. And I said, next stage of what? I just want to meet the head of the program. And at that point, they were like, we really, really love you. Would you consider doing this? And I went, sounds really good. Okay. Yes, I'll do it. So that's what got me to Spotify.
Oh, that's fantastic. And that certainly was a great opportunity. What I want to highlight about that is that the opportunity that came to work with Spotify came because all of the work that you had done prior.
Correct.
Right? There's the saying that every overnight success is a decade in the making.
Yes.
And that opportunity would not have occurred had you not been working on all those other podcasts and creating your own business for the 10 years prior.
Absolutely not. And one thing that I struggle with, believe it or not, is shining my light. I'm great at shining other people's light, but for all the things that people see that I have done, there's a ton more that I've done that I don't talk about because I'm doing the work. And I often get told off about that by my inner circle, because actually, you know, if people knew that I did this, you know, all of these other things, the story might be different. But for me, I don't see it because I'm so into the work. Oftentimes for me, the thing that I have to work on is making sure that people can see that, not because I want to be seen, but because that work is important as well. But you're absolutely right. That is, and I say that because that for me at this point in time is the lesson that I'm sitting with. You know, don't be afraid to say that you're working on this thing, even if you're coming at it imperfectly. Perfectionism is a real issue for me as well. Like, I always want to be like, all the ducks have to be in a row and then maybe I'll talk about it. But I've come to accept and actually sit in this idea of, no, imperfection is the thing because you're working on it. Iteration, right? You iterate and you iterate and you iterate. And actually, that's where the value lies. It's in the you trying something and not knowing the answer and working in real time, because that's where all of the gems are. That's where the wisdom lies.
Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned that word iteration, and that leads to evolution. Iteration creates evolution.
Yes.
And evolution is the name of the game. If I look back, and occasionally I do, and it's terrifying, I look back at like the videos that I put up on YouTube in 2009. Oof. They're horrifying.
Oh, of course. Well, I don't doubt
why it. Am I dressed like that? Why is my background like that? Why is the lighting like that? But without those videos in 2009, I wouldn't be where I am now. Mm-hmm. And we just have to keep trying and trying something new.
Yeah.
Okay, talk to me about how you achieve balance between your career and your personal life and your family. What's your family like, your personal family?
I have two kids aged 8 and 10, and I am married.
Okay. So yes. How do you make time for them? How do you maintain balance with a young family like that? My youngest is 10, so I can relate to that.
Yeah. I forgot to add, I also have two cats. So there's six souls in my house. So a lot of life in my house. Okay. I put them first as best as I can. As somebody who's very, very driven, I do put them first. But I will say that that's the other reason why I created My Lens Media, right? Because I hadn't had kids at the time, but I very much understood that I wanted to work differently, right? As somebody who was working in a news environment where things were so intense and I was working crazy hours, I wanted to take control back of that because I could see that it was actually affecting my health in all the ways as well. And I just wasn't happy. And so for my sense, I was like, there has to be another way to do this, which is why I wanted to build the business and work with other people on my terms. So for me now, you know, and I will say that the business actually helped me negotiate my work with Spotify, because part of the reason as to why I didn't want to work with them was because I was protecting that life that I had with the people that I live with and love. And so that helped me negotiate the, I do drop-offs, that's not going to change. They were like, that's fine. Okay, well, my kids are going to have stuff, I'm going to go to that. Okay, we absolutely understand that. It gave me the voice to ask for what I wanted.
Mm.
And then it gave me the voice to say, this is what I wanted. And so I guess that's the long answer of saying, I still do that with the business. Things are protected and I won't touch it.
Yeah, you're creating that boundary.
Yes.
And because you create the boundary, other people respect it. In hindsight, could you have created that boundary without your business?
Oh, yeah.
But you just held yourself back from doing it?
Yes.
Okay.
I didn't even hold myself back. I didn't know how to do it. Mm. I didn't know how, because I was taught to believe that if I work hard, not smart, if I work hard, then the things will come to me. And in every job prior to that, I was scared. I was scared, you know, like, I don't want to lose my job. So I have to show them that I can do these things. What I didn't realize was that in turning up and showing who I was already showing people what I could do and who I was. I just didn't know how to ask for it. Having the business did more than, like, for me, success is not just about having the business or about the financial bottom line. That's actually the least of it for me. Having the business really showed me how to work differently. And in a way that is far more healthy. And to me, that is success, right? Because if my kid has a recital at school, I went. It's not a problem. I don't feel any way about that. I'm doing that because you know what I learned? I learned that I can still do the job really well. I don't have to be at the desk at that time.
Yes. And I would argue you can do the job better.
Better.
If you create the boundary, because it forces you to be more efficient and more productive.
I agree. Right?
If you allow the interruptions to happen all the time, you're not getting better. You're just getting sloppy.
Exactly. Exactly. That's absolutely what I've learned. And that's where I am right now. So whatever is coming in the future, that is what I absolutely know I'm going to bring to that. And I'm excited about that because there's tons of stuff that I want to do, you know, in the future.
So speaking of the future, I always like to ask, what do you see things 5 years from now for you and your career?
5 years from now, My Lens Media is helping to inspire creators around the world to build their businesses, right? To lean into what they are passionate about. And to try. And what I mean by that is me using all of this experience that I have to give people the practical tools about, well, how do I build the podcast? There are a lot of people who say, this is how you build the podcast, but no one's actually saying how. They're saying, this is what you need to do. But there is a way in which I want to continue to show people and guide people in terms of how they build the business, right? How they can build their own business and how they can tell their own stories. I'm using the word business, but there's almost like, for me, it's like, tell your story. I'm here to help you tell your story, right? And I want you to find your audience, the people you want to talk to, and grow that business, right? Because that's really what you want to do through audio and connect communities through audio, right? And maybe I'll be a few years off selling the business, My Lens Media, because I'm also looking at, okay, well, I want to really spend some time with my kids and kind of, you know, wherever they're at, I can go and see them and meet them.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, that's going to be all about how you build that team to run that business.
Exactly.
Well, Thank you so much for being generous with your story, Christabel. So this is the point where we pause, and if people have been listening to my podcast, they know what's coming here. So my belief is that it's not so much about the knowledge that you gain, but the action that you take on that knowledge. Mm. In other words, what you output is more important than what you input. And we got lots of wonderful stuff from Christabel. Now it's time for you to do something about it. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to summarize three principles of easily actionable things that someone listening to it can do. And then if they do that, you become a part of their life forever. So I'm going to share three possible actions, and then I'd love if you come in with one, maybe two quick actionable things at the end that you would recommend to people. So the first thing, I'm going to go back to the beginning of your interviews, is that concept of listening disarms people, about how when you're having a conversation with someone, you just pause and you listen and you be silent. Mm-hmm. And that will help them, win them to your side, and will also help you learn things. So one action that someone could take this week is, in the next conversation that they have, find moments to pause and listen and be quiet. Just practice that skill. I also liked how in your story, so many of the turning points for your career came from trying something where the outcome was not known. Mm-hmm. Where you took a risk, when you took that opportunity to go to New York and do that even without getting paid. I have found that the things that we are most often afraid to do are the very things that we should do and will lead us to the greatest amount of success. So if someone's listening to this and they've got that thing in the back of their head, that thing that's nagging them where they go, I don't know if I should do that. This isn't going to turn out well. I would encourage you to move forward with it and take the risk. And then the last thing is what we discussed near the end, was that you can create boundaries in your day. And you do not have to be a business owner to do that. I had a conversation with a friend through text message, and he's like, Dave, how do you take 2 months off every year? And I said, it starts with taking 1 day off per month. So communicate that to your employer, communicate that to your customers, whatever you do, create a boundary, and then maybe stretch it a little bit each time. So Christabel, what action would you suggest in addition to that, this wonderful list that you've helped us create?
Well, thank you. And also you saying that, talking about the New York adventure, I listening back to that, I'm like, that was crazy talk. I can't believe I did that, but I did, and yay. The thing that comes to mind from point one is be open to change. And I think what I mean, and really, I think what be open is really the thing, because when you were talking about the conversation, what I meant was be open to the possibility of change, right? Even in the conversation, you have to come at it like an 8-year-old would or a 4-year-old would. Just come at it openly. Because you don't know what is happening, and that's not a bad thing. But come at it with an open heart and an open mind. And whatever you do in all of it, whatever you choose to do in the way you communicate with people, in the way you approach, you know, the first minute or the first hour of your working day, the way you approach asking for, be open.
I love it. It's a great mindset to have. It'll help you be successful no matter what you're trying to accomplish.
Yeah.
Christabel, this has been a delight talking to you and getting to know your story. Thank you so much for your generosity of sharing this.
Thank you so much for having me. I've really loved this conversation. Thank you.
And thank you, everyone, for listening. Remember, it's not just about what you heard. It's about what you do. So go out, take some action on what Christabel shared, and you're going to move yourself closer to success. Have a great day.
You've been listening to the Dave Crenshaw Success Project, hosted by my dad, Dave Crenshaw, and produced by Invaluable Incorporated. Sound editing was done by my brother, Stratton Crenshaw. Research and assistant production by Victoria Bidez. Voiceover by me, Darcy Crenshaw. And the music is by Ryan Brady via Pond 5 Licensing. Please subscribe to the Dave Crenshaw Success Project on Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you like to get your podcasts. And please don't forget to leave us a 5-star review. See you next time.